Welcome to the Hardware Asylum Podcast Extras. In this episode, we take a deep dive into our new retro PC gaming build and what it takes to run these old machines. I'm 16-bit Dennis, and with me today I have 8-bit Darren. In the last episode, we talked about the latest and greatest in processor technology, the Ryzen 9 or the Core i9, and whether or not you should be building a PC using one processor technology or the other. And that reminded me, this is an age-old discussion that goes way back, long time ago.
It does. The rivalry goes back almost as far as I've been building custom PCs.
Well, yeah, and same here. Well, even before I've been building custom PCs. And the thing is, there was always an adage that was, you know, whenever you ask somebody, well, what should I buy? What should I build? Well, it depends on what you're going to do. And I wanted to explore that a little bit more now that I've gotten older and a little bit wiser. And, you know, I have a lot of some of this, retro grade computer hardware stored away. We talked about the Pentium Pro motherboard last month. And I got a bug.
Uh-oh.
I got a retro bug.
A retro bug? What? Is this like a midlife hardware crisis?
I think it might be.
Oh, no.
Actually. But the thing is, I like messing around with old computer stuff. I found out that when I was playing Quake 2 and Quake 1 on a Pentium Pro system with two Voodoo 2s and SLI, I mean, that was really a golden age of gaming for me.
Oh, that does bring back the feels too, because everything was so hot and fresh back in those days. It just seemed like every time you looked, there was something new.
Yeah, and back then it was like, well, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to game. Well, since you're going to game, you need to have this, 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 and this. There was a definite formula on what you needed to put into a computer to be able to game. Whereas now it's like, well, do I want the Ryzen 9 because I can get 4 frames per second faster than an overclocked Core i9 10900K? Where's the definition there?
I guess they might be the good frames.
Yeah, that's a good point. It could be the good frames. I have an item here. We're going to do another radio unboxing.
It's beautiful, but it's not in a box.
It is a box.
One would argue then it might not be beautiful.
That's true.
It is interesting, though.
Yeah, so we have a computer case. And I'm going to say that this computer case is probably manufactured circa 1992-ish.
Yeah, that might actually be right. So I don't even recognize the case or case brand, but I can tell you that what we're looking at here is a classic beige box.
It is a classic beige box. It's the darker beige. It's not the yellow beige. It's not the sun bleached beige.
Well, that might just be because this one hasn't been in the sun. So
it's true.
All right. It's right here. I'm going to look at it because I can't not touch it any longer. So it says Micro 386 on the front.
Yeah. What I found out is that this particular case design, we're talking about an old case, really.
So old, we'll get pictures.
You're
going to need pictures.
Yeah. This particular design of chassis was introduced in the late 80s, and it kind of ran until early to mid 90s. And there was very many different iterations of this case. Some of them had an LED display. Most of them had a turbo button. Almost every one of them had a key lock. But the order on how those showed up on the bezel changed based off of what company ordered the cases to be manufactured. So
I so want to find a date on this thing, and there just isn't one.
There should be one on the back, the sticker.
I looked at that, but I think that's a sticker from an IT department.
Yeah, that's the invoicing sticker.
Because it says that this is an MMC company, model Micro 3300. This is a serial number. And the date on it is 4/18 of 1991.
Ah, okay. So there we go. 1991.
And I can't say that that's when this machine was brand new.
I'm going to say it probably is because inside it, I mean, while the sticker on the outside says Micro 386, the build inside is not. We have a 486 DX 33 megahertz.
I'm making a lot of noise here, I think, Dennis, but it's because there are more cables in this case cable select,
there's no room for cable management in this chassis.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. Well, and that was a problem with the beige box, which is why we like to bash on the beige box, because you put a build into it and you didn't look at it. You basically looked at the outside. That was it. You walled it off. So it didn't matter what it looked like on the inside. And when we started building performance PCs, we started doing things like rounding the ribbon cables. Remember that, where you take like every 10th one and then cut it? Well, not cut the cable, but cut the ribbon so that you could flatten them.
It doesn't even have a fan.
It has a fan on... No, it doesn't. It has a fan in the power supply.
It does. I can't even begin. It's like a weird flashback.
Yeah. Well, and that's this retro movement. There's it's kind of a growing thing. It's a very niche, somewhat like overclocking these days, where people go and buy old vintage computers and either fix them up to play retro games.
Oh, which is cool.
Or which if you're trying to do a preservation of old retro hardware, which, you know, why would you? Some people go and buy these cases just so that they can modernize them. So they'll go and rip out all the old hardware and then mod the case to put in new stuff.
Oh, now we're talking like cars, right? So that's a retro mod style movement.
Yeah, restro mod or whatever.
That I kind of get, because you could really make a cool sleeper out of this, which we have done in the past.
We have. And I don't necessarily want to do that with this particular build, because I've been there, done that. I mean, I've built cases similar to this in the past and then threw them away, which now I'm kicking myself, because I could actually pull them out and do stuff with them.
No kidding. I mean, I've thrown away nicer hardware than this, maybe, which is sort of scary that it's got some value again, but it's kind of like the cars. I mean, we just sort of went there with the resto mod thing, but I think it's really an apt comparison.
You know, well, okay. So let's just make that comparison. So we have cars. Everybody, well, we would hope everybody listening to this podcast knows about cars, but we have the brand new car. Say you go down, you get, you lease a vehicle or you buy it outright, and it's basically new for that user for about 3 years. And at that point, the warranty tends to run out. Sometimes they go 6 years for like Kias and Hondas and stuff like that.
But I get the image, yeah.
But at the time that the warranty runs out, the people that buy these new cars, they get rid of them, because at that point they start becoming a cash sponge. So things start to break. They don't necessarily want to pay for it. They want to just pay for using the car. So they'll go and trade it in, buy a brand new car. And then we have this used car market, which lasts for about 7 to 10 years. And that's the age of the car. And at that point, the mileage gets up so high that people don't want to buy them anymore. So they go and get sold at auction and crushed, or they get in an accident and then it becomes a warranty claim. Well, PC hardware is very similar in terms of, we have the latest and greatest, the stuff that we normally buy, we keep for 1, 2, maybe 3 years.
Right.
And at that point, it's time for the upgrade. And whether or not we actually replace one component or replace everything in the build, that is really just dependent on what has changed in 3 years.
Right.
What do we do with our old hardware? Well, sometimes we can't pay to get rid of it.
That's the truth.
Well, wait 7, 10, 15, 20 years, and now you have a piece of hardware that is in such demand that it commands a 5-time price increase of what it was when it was brand new.
Oh, we see that same thing in a lot of cars. If it's a popular or desirable car.
Yeah.
You know, I know in this state, a car is officially a classic if it's over 20 years old, for example.
Yeah, well, and, you know, a lot of people that sell these type of cases and whatnot, they sell it as vintage. And it's designed to be vintage. Or I should say, it's not necessarily designed to be vintage. It's intended to be a classic purchase. People are going to be buying this because, not that they want to go and destroy it, but they're going to want to do something with it.
Okay, so I see, I guess, the appeal. And I really am kind of excited about being able to play some ancient games. I still have a couple of CDs that I'm not even sure I can play in my modern PC.
You can play some of like the old like Flight Simulator 5 and stuff like that. You can play that in DOSBox, but there's so many switches that you have to configure in that system to be able to play the game that it's almost easier to put together an old computer to go and do that. So,
all right, well, let's maybe stop and let's walk through the what's in the box here, because I think that is very interesting, because there's stuff in here I don't recognize, which is very cool.
Okay. I'm not sure if those will translate to photos, but we will describe them as best we can. All right. Let's start on the outside.
Start on the outside. So we're looking at the front of this thing. And what's mostly entertaining about this is that everything is labeled, which did you do that or did it come this way?
It came this way. It was labeled. And I'm not sure exactly why. And I was really trying to figure out why this computer was built in this way, because it makes absolutely no sense to me.
Well, I'm looking at, has three five and a quarters.
Yeah, three external 5 1/4.
And they're labeled AEF, which is interesting to me because he's probably got the drives, or had, I'm assuming it's a he, just for sake of better, numbered, because I see a B on the side.
Well, there was a...
Up, there's B.
There's B.
Is the floppy. So the C drive is probably the internal, and there must be a D internal, because then it goes EF, right?
Yeah, there were two internal hard drives.
Nice.
We had a 340 meg hard drive.
Beautiful. Hey, is that a caviar?
It is a caviar.
Nice. Those are great drives.
Yeah.
Well, they're both caviars.
And then we have a 420, which has the stripe on it, which was classic. You know, you'd always know you got a good hard drive when it had the stripe on it. But they're both Western Digital caviars, both IDE old. And then that was in the drive cage, which I removed, that had also the 3.5-inch B drive.
Wow.
And then we have our 3 5 1/4. A drive was a 1.2 meg, which is the high density drive. And then we have two 360K drives, which is the double density version.
Yeah, you know, honestly, I'd have had to dust that little fact off. I didn't remember that you had to get them in different sizes.
Well, you're not supposed to, but it's based off of age. So anything that was in the 80, 86 to 286 region was probably a 360K drive, unless you spent a whole ton of money on the hardware for it.
So let's turn it and look at the inside here. So it's got a really fancy power supply.
Oh, yeah. The power supplies back then were chrome plated. I don't know if there's like an electrical benefit to that, but I've never seen a PCAT style power supply that was not chrome plated.
Do you have any idea what the stats are on it, or have you looked?
I have not looked, but so, I'm going to guess it's not very powerful.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I was going with it. It probably has a label hidden on it somewhere if it hasn't worn off. But this is kind of where things get interesting for me, because you have this cool little adapter here.
Oh, yeah. So PCAT required, I think there's 10 pins in there.
Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 12 pins. So.
12 pins. So to power a motherboard, you had 12 copper pins that were in a straight line. And then to turn on the power supply, there was a couple of wires that came off the PSU that went to the power switch. Well, the adapter that you have there allows you to adapt a 20-pin power supply to that 12-pin adaptation.
That's probably a good purchase, because who knows what kind of condition this power supply is in.
Well, I have turned it on. It has worked, but I don't know how much longer it's going to last.
Nice.
The motherboard itself, if we go and look at the board, it's a 486.
Okay, yeah.
And the power plug is in the upper left, and we only have a single keyboard connector. That's the only external connector from the motherboard. And if you turn it again, in the back, there's that round circle right there.
Oh, it's the big one.
Yeah, that's the PC XT keyboard. It's the big one.
Yeah, big round one there.
Yeah, and of course you can get adapters for the XT to PS2, and then you can get PS2 to USB, but I don't know if those actually work.
Very interesting. I see, looks like 8 RAM modules in 2 different styles here.
And that makes sense, because those are 30-pin SIMs, and you have to reinstall 4 modules at once to be able to make them work.
So how much memory does this machine have, do you know?
4 megs.
Wow, crossed 8 sticks. And they're single-sided, which I had forgotten about too.
Well, and back in the 30-pin SIM days, to get 4 megs of memory, it was like $300 or something like that.
Oh, geez. I've seen the ads where it was even more than that. I know my first machine had 4 in it. I felt like I was super spoiled.
We're not dating ourselves at all.
Oh, God. Yeah, no kidding. Let's not talk about Bill Gates quotes, but you should Google Bill Gates quotes. Anyway, what processor did you say this is? The 486? Which one?
486, 33 megahertz. I think it's just the DX edition. I don't think it's a DX2 or a DX4.
Okay.
I do have a couple of DX4s in my collection. One AMD is 120 megahertz, and then 100, I think.
So then you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 cards in here, and I recognize one of them is the video card, and I'm going to have to turn it to the back so I can see what the heck the others are.
Well, it's nice because they're all labeled, right?
Oh, yeah, they are. Okay, so we got...
So the very top card is a special card that allows you to run the 2 floppy drives. So the E and the F drive
right.
are run off of that card. It's basically an I.O. adapter or an I.O. expansion card.
COM1 and COM2, now we know.
Well, COM1 and COM2 actually come off of the hard drive controller, which is a separate card. And that is what will give you access to your hard drives and also to the 2 primary floppy drives, the C and the B.
Okay. So then the next one down, well, let's see, it's got a printer port and a game port on it.
And that's the I.O. card.
Okay, and then you've got your video card.
And the video card is a, I don't think it's in VLB bus, the VESA bus. That was the longer card with the separate plug on it. I think it's just a standard ISA GP card.
Yeah, it sure doesn't look like it. But you have a second set of dip switches here on your monitor here, which is interesting.
Yeah, I'm not sure what those are for, to be honest. But once I dissect this computer, and I'm going to do a video of that, so I'll... We'll have it posted on Hardware Asylum for sure. But when I pull that out, we'll have to look at the model number and see what's what.
So the next one looks very familiar to me. It looks like a really early generation sound card there.
Mm-hmm. It's probably a Sound Blaster 16, but I'm not sure.
And it also has a game port on it, which is nice. And then below that, it looks like a proprietary card with, normally it has an S-Video, but this old has to be a PS2, right?
I'm not sure.
Or something proprietary, maybe.
I'm not sure what that particular card is, to be honest.
It's labeled scan, so it could be a proprietary output.
Mm-hmm, for, obviously, a scanner. And then the last card is labeled CD-ROM.
CD audio and CD power for an external CD device, perhaps?
Yeah, it has to be, because in this era, we didn't have internal CD-ROM drives. But the CD-ROMs that you could buy that were like $1,500 or whatever... They had their own proprietary interface, and I think that card is for that.
Very interesting.
When I rebuild this box, I probably will not be able to find an external CD-ROM, so that card will probably be taken out.
Well, now that I'm looking at it internally, it looks like the second port that we talked about is just an add-on card.
Oh, yeah, that's the... So when you have the I.O. card itself, on board it has a whole bunch of ribbon connectors. So you have a ribbon connector for the 2 floppy drives, you have another ribbon connector for your hard drives, and then you have some other connectors for a parallel port and a serial port. And then the I.O. card itself usually comes with a set of ports as well.
Well, looking at the cards internally, it looks like the newest cards are this top one, the compact iCard 4.
Yeah, and that's the one that drives the other 2 floppy drives. Now, the thing that I can't quite figure out is why you would need 4, 5 1/4 inch floppy drives. Because the 1.2 meg drive will read 360K disks. So you don't need to have that as reverse compatibility. But then I was like, well, maybe he's doing like copying of disks or
that's
something.
That's all I can think of.
Well, and I don't know, it could have been in the history of this previous owner, but... When I had, I think I talked about this on the podcast, but one of my first computers was a Tandy 1000, and it only had 2 360K 5 1/4 drives. It didn't have a hard drive or anything. And I had to use both drives to sometimes play games, save the game to one drive because it wouldn't fit on the disk. It was actually physically too big. So,
Well, I know because in my family we have professors. Some of these early machines were used to copy assignments and stuff onto students' machines. And I know you had thought maybe this had a early teacher of some sort in it. So he may have been using that to copy lesson plans or something onto multiple disks, and you could do two or three at a time.
Oh, that's true. And that might explain why there was a scanner and a CD-ROM.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's some history there that we'll have to uncover if we can figure out who the previous owner was. But for now, what I would like to do is, you know, I'll do a video of ripping everything out and show you what all was inside. And then I would like to go through and actually restore this PC. Not necessarily put the hardware back into it, but freshen up the case. Not necessarily change anything about it, but kind of clean it up. Like some of the tabs in here are bent, so fix those up. And I would like to put a coat of paint on it because I don't necessarily like this gray.
Nah, the beige box.
But I do want to put like a flat black in here and do like an automotive quality matte black finish on the inside of the case.
Yeah, maybe we'll have to do some lasering or anodizing or something just to, you know, amp it up a bit.
Oh, of course. And the outside of it, I would like to keep it the beige, but there's some problems. So on the front of the case, the power switch, which is a standard two-pole rocker switch, is broken. On one side of it, you can see that it wiggles.
Oh, that'd get annoying, I guess.
Well, and it's basically destined to break pretty soon. And it's already pretty smooth, like it's been used a lot. Unfortunately, you can't get a brown-gray switch like that anymore.
Interesting.
The only rocker switches that are that size and that polarity are black. So that got me thinking, maybe what we can do is 3D model this bezel and then 3D print it.
That could be fun. And then you could do some real custom stuff.
Yeah, that way we can make it a like a black ABS, you know, do the high quality filament. And then, of course, we can open this up, maybe put some vents in there, and then leave this bezel alone, because this is actually one of the more desirable designs for retro PC towers. But if I can replace it with something, then I won't feel too bad about actually modifying the rest of the case.
Well, yeah, because you might want to put some fans in it or, you know, anything and make it breathe better.
Oh, yeah.
Is your goal to put modern hardware in this then?
Not necessarily. What I would like to do is make it a test bed for retro stuff. So while it is an AT-style chassis, I don't want to convert it to ATX style, because I have other cases for that. I mean, right. I have plenty of other cases for that. But I can experiment with AT style hardware. So for instance, I can get a Pentium Pro that would fit in this motherboard form factor. So that way I can build another Pentium Pro system and have it fit in this case. Or I can build a 486, you know, take some of my other 486 boards, put in here and actually build a nice, very capable gaming PC to play year-specific games.
Well, I think that's a really cool goal, to be able to put together a machine and go back and visit that era in time.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it would, in a way, it would also make kind of a nice LAN party edition. So we could take this along and set it up and allow people to play, like, you know, the original King's Quest or something.
Ah, have fun.
Yeah, you know, just load the hard drive up with some old classic games. We can run them on the 486. And it will be just like, you know, taking a step back in time.
So I have to ask, because I'm curious, with the retro demand for these things, what's a project like this cost?
I'm a little embarrassed to say. But this particular case, I got this is off of eBay, and it was an auction that I won at the very last minute because, you know, you have to do the auction thing.
Oh, yeah.
It went for $360 complete.
Oh, wow. So there is really a demand for these types of machines.
Mm-hmm. And there was, at the time, a mini tower version with the same style that was completely empty and didn't have the LED readout, which is something that I really wanted.
Yeah.
It was listed for $250, and it sold shortly after this one sold.
Wow.
And, you know, as a bare case with absolutely nothing in it, I didn't think that it was worth $250. But considering how much I paid here, and if I was to sell the hardware inside it, I could probably recoup half of my cost just because of the demand for these old motherboards and stuff like that.
Well, that's amazing. Honestly, I think it makes me wonder if I have any old machines left in my closet somewhere. And if you're out there listening, maybe you should check too.
And of course, if you are considering this, there are a few key things that you need to know. These are things that I've also figured out, having lived during this era and built some of these machines. The hard drives are really becoming, they're becoming really difficult to find. Now, this computer came with two of them, and I mentioned it was 340 megabytes. Well, most of the computers that you buy, the hard drives are destroyed. And that's really for, you know, personal reasons. You don't want to give away your personal information.
That makes sense.
Somebody could get something off of there and whatnot. And the hard drive is really one of the consumable items that, as you know, the bearings go bad. They make a lot of noise. Sometimes they get bad spots. And they are often replaced with larger drives as they become cheaper. The small ones like this that work with this old hardware are really hard to find in working order. And if you do, they can go for like $200-$300.
Well, I imagine some of that demand is because we know that there are businesses that are stuck on this old hardware that have to stockpile these old parts because their machines are not compatible with newer hardware.
Yeah. Well, and that's when I started hitting up Amazon and eBay for alternatives. So we have adapters that you can buy. It seems to be adapters for everything, which is actually pretty cool. So on the hard drive front, we have IDE to SATA adapters. So if you have an IDE drive and you need to plug it into a computer with the SATA controller, you plug your connector in here, power into the drive, and then there's a chip on there that will convert SATA signals into IDE signals. Now, the one that I purchased off of Amazon is reversible. So you can plug it into a motherboard and have a SATA controller on a 486. Yeah, so that way you can run your new SATA drives. Like, I have a couple of 36 gig Raptors that I was able to run on that Pentium Pro board by putting that adapter on there. Now, on the 486, the IDE interface is slightly different, so there might be some issues there, which is why you can get compact flash adapters as well. And they don't have a chip, and they don't really have a power requirement, aside from just plugging in a floppy connector. But that allows you to run a compact flash and have it read exactly like an IDE hard drive.
Well, that's a little scary to think that you can get a compact flash that's as big or bigger than original hard drives.
Well,
that's just how far the world has come.
Well, it's true. And if you're running MS-DOS or Windows 3.1, you have a size limit on the FAT table. FAT 16 can only go up to, was it 2 gigs?
Oh, I know, it was something very small.
Yeah, I think it was 2 gigabytes. So on, you know, my 36 gig Raptor, I would have to partition it, was like 10 times before I could actually use the entire drive.
Wow.
Which isn't necessarily a bad thing, because there isn't a lot with Windows 3.1. It came on floppy drives, and the software that runs in that system is actually pretty small.
But you do also make a valid point, because the software isn't exactly readily available. Most people threw it out.
That is true. And there are archives online that have some of that software that you can download. Like, you can get old versions of SimCity, the original edition, because it's considered abandonware. The company doesn't care that it's being shared, which is good for us. The one final drive solution that I found allows you to use SD cards as IDE hard drives. So you can take your SD card out of your phone and plug it into your controller and run your operating system off it. So do you remember back when we were, you know, Windows 95, Windows 98, why we rated hard drives?
Oh, because that was the only way you could get them fast.
Right. Well, when I was running that SATA connector on the Pentium Pro board, my first iteration was actually to put an old Micron SSD in there. And the speed reminded me of why we rated drives back then. Well, that SSD is fast enough that it saturated the IDE bus, and it didn't need to rate any drives anymore.
Well, that's a nice plus. And cheaper probably than tracking down those old hard drives too. Well, Dennis, it's definitely going to be interesting to see if you can get this thing up and running as a retro gaming PC. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of looking forward to seeing some of those old game and software titles again.
Well, and hopefully we can get some 3D printing on your machine at your place.
And that'll be cool too. So retro PC, maybe it's not for you, but it's definitely a rising movement. We'll check back on this project again soon.
For more information on the topics discussed in this podcast, please consult our show notes at hardwareasylum.com. Stay up to date on the latest at Hardware Asylum by subscribing to our RSS. Follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook. This has been a Ninja Lane production, copyright 2021. Thanks for listening.